Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program today, tackling Fresno's homeless crisis. Will a housing-first approach be the answer? And we examine the results of the election, what worked and what didn't. And a Fresno couple gives back how their gift will help hundreds of Fresno Unified students. But first, now that the dust has settled after this month's general election, political observers are busy examining the results to see just what effect California's new redistricting maps and electoral reforms had in their first full test at the ballot box. Valley Public Radio's Joe Moore reports that, in some cases, the result is too close to call.
For most California voters, the trip to the ballot box this November looked much like it always has, albeit with longer lines at some polling places and a record number of vote-by-mail ballots. But the biggest changes actually took place behind the scenes, as this month's election was the state's first under new district maps drawn by the Citizens Redistricting Commission and the first complete cycle under the state's new Top 2 Elections Law. So exactly what effect did those reforms have on election results across the state? Eric McGee, a policy fellow with the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California, says the biggest change was in the number of close outcomes.
There were a lot more of those races this time around than we had seen over the previous five election cycles.
In 2012, 18% of races between candidates of opposing parties were decided by a margin of less than 10 points. That's over double the average from elections over the past decade. And in the 28 races where candidates from the same party faced each other in the general election, 27 took place in districts which had not seen competitive races in the past.
The same party races was a real innovation. I don't think anybody knew quite what to expect out of those. And they made for competitive contests in districts where you just simply would not have had one in the past, where the number of competitive races would have been zero in the fall election. And now it was a third of those races were competitive by that standard.
Kim Alexander, president and founder of the California Voter Foundation, says the new process made the June primary more competitive as well.
Those candidates that made it into the top two and got onto the ballot in the general fought very hard in the primary to get there. And many of them found themselves appealing to voters from other parties and independent voters in order to secure a place on the ballot for fall. So I do think that we saw this election year more in June than in November. We saw candidates reaching out across the aisles, trying to get supporters that they normally wouldn't be courting to back their candidacy.
She says that the new primary system, combined with new district maps, also made life more difficult for incumbents, especially those in districts that lean heavily towards one party.
I mean, it used to be that if you didn't like the incumbent of your party who was representing you in Congress or in the legislature, you had to wait till that person retired or was term limited out of their seat to actually do anything about it, to run yourself or to find someone to run against them. And now because of the top two, I would argue that, you know, people don't have to wait anymore. They can actually challenge a sitting incumbent in the primary, and we saw a lot of that happen this year.
Still, incumbents had a pretty good track record, with just three losses in the Assembly, none in the state Senate, and seven in the U.S. House. Voters ushered in this new era in California politics back in 2010, when Proposition 14 became law with 53% of the vote. Before this election cycle, each party would field its own candidate in the November general election. This year, voters in the primary got to choose from a long list of candidates from multiple parties, and only the top two went on to the general election. Supporters claimed it would not only lead to more competitive races, but also would bring out more moderate candidates.
One of the primary goals that people had for these reforms was to elect more moderates to office, people who would be willing to cross party lines to get things done and solve the problems facing the state and the nation. And I think it's just too early still to say whether that has happened.
Opponents, however, claim the top two primary system also hurts voter choice, and helps to reinforce the two dominant political parties. Many of California's smaller parties are concerned that their candidates might never stand a chance of making it to the top two under the current system. And even in the primary, voters face a different dilemma.
The primary voting system, when you have five Republicans and four Democrats and three Libertarians and four Greens and two this and four that, the dynamic is even harder for us to get our true vote there than it is otherwise because of the lesser of evil dynamic.
That's Michael Feinstein, spokesperson for the Green Party of California.
If you're somebody who thinks green but is concerned that the greenest Democrat make it into the November runoff of the only top two, then there's even less incentive for you to vote green there than it is in the general election.
Keith Smith, an assistant professor of political science at the University of the Pacific, agrees that the system hurts voter choice and reinforces the two-party system. He says that while other countries that have tried the top two system have seen it lead to the growth of multiple parties,
that's true, except when you switch from a system that has a strong two-party system like we've had in California, like we have in California, with two dominant political parties, that stays when you make the change.
And even supporters like Alexander note that opponents of Prop 14, who claim the law would lead to more expensive elections, were proved correct.
And so that is definitely one of the byproducts that you get when you have more competition. So, you know, on the one hand, people think, well, competition's a good thing, we need more of it. On the other hand, they say, wow, this is costing a lot of money to have all these competitive races up and down the state. You know, who's paying for all this and what are we going to owe them down the line? And that's a very fair concern.
So what does the future hold? Kim Alexander says she thinks the major parties and candidates may adapt to the new system.
You know, one thing that we saw a few instances of this election were candidates who wanted to get in the top two, were eyeing the other candidates in the race, saw someone who they thought was a threat to them, and ended up pushing a different candidate successfully and pushed their leading opponent out altogether. So you do see this kind of monkeying around in the primaries. I think more of that may go on, where you've got candidates not only pushing their own candidacy, but also promoting another candidate who may be weaker's candidacy so that they have a weaker opponent in the general.
But despite the changes, in some ways, the future may be more of the same. The average margin of victory for incumbents in the November election was 33%, about the same as the average over the past 10 years. And even in contests between candidates of the same party, the candidate who won the party's official endorsement most often won at the ballot box as well. As for the theory that the top two system may lead to more moderates in office, Professor Smith says that as long as powerful interest groups, labor on the left and anti-tax groups on the right, retain their influence, little is likely to change.
Maybe the parties moderate a little bit, but I don't see them moderating their positions that much, and I certainly don't see the affiliated groups moderating their positions in a way that would get us different kinds of candidates running for office.
And McGee says in other states that have tried this sort of election reform, the long-term results aren't all that dramatically different.
And if you look at how these kinds of reforms have played out in other states in the past, they haven't had a huge impact. They've had maybe a very small, on-the-margins kind of impact.
He says the bigger change in Sacramento in the near future may actually be much more old-fashioned in the form of the supermajority that Democrats now hold in the legislature.
How does that change the political dynamic? Is this going to embolden Democrats to be more radical in some sense, or is it going to make some of the key votes that are necessary for any kind of two-thirds type decision, any of those Democratic votes, more cautious and more sort of moderate as a result? We just don't know the answer to that, but it definitely muddies the waters in terms of evaluating the impact of these reforms.
For Valley Public Radio, I'm Joe Moore.
Next week, we continue our series on the aftermath of California's new electoral reforms. We'll learn why some of California's smaller political parties are worried that the new top two system may actually lead to their extension. That's next week on Valley Edition. Now, while political junkies are still weighing in on the impact of changes to the state's election laws, one thing from this month's election is clear. It was a landmark election for California Democrats. The party gained a supermajority in both state legislative houses for the first time in 70 years. But as KPCC's Julie Small reports, the assembly speaker says his party won't exploit the power.
The two-thirds majority in the Assembly and Senate gives Democrats the power to raise taxes without Republican votes. They'll also be able to expedite bills and change legislative rules. But Assembly Speaker John Perez downplays that new power.
The job is the same as it's always been, to focus on continuing to stabilize the economy, continue to make improvements in our budgetary situation, and focusing on business expansion so we can get everybody back to work in California.
And as for wielding the new power to raise taxes, Perez says that's not on the Assembly's agenda. The speaker notes that with the passage of Prop 30, voters have already agreed to raise income and sales tax to prevent cuts to public schools. And they voted to close a corporate tax loophole. Together, those changes give lawmakers an estimated $7 billion in new revenue to help balance the budget. The supermajority power in both state houses also enables Democrats to override gubernatorial vetoes. Speaker Perez says he doesn't expect to use it.
The way to make things work is to actually try to work together, not to try to engage in divisive activities and, you know, pursue a confrontational approach.
The last time the legislature overrode a governor's veto was in 1979 during Governor Jerry Brown's first term. At a news conference, Brown said he's not worried.
I have more experience with veto overrides than any other governor. So I think I can handle the problem without too much difficulty.
Brown believes the Democrats' supermajority is more likely to ease the way for regulatory reform, a stable water supply, building high-speed rail, and changes to educational standards, evaluations, and testing. I'm Julie Small.
Now we're going to take a look at one of the issues that it's been huge in Fresno. There are an estimated 5,000 homeless people in Fresno County, some living on the streets. It is a problem Fresno has struggled with for years. But a philosophy embraced by the executive director of the Fresno Housing Authority could be the beginning of a solution. Joining me now is Preston Prince, executive director of the Housing Authority. Thanks so much for coming in, especially 2 days before the holiday.
I'm very happy to be here.
We appreciate it. Now, first of all, the approach that we're talking about, or the philosophy called Housing First, it's not new. Many communities are really moving in that direction when it comes to addressing their homeless situation. Explain what that means. What is that whole concept?
Well, Housing First has been around for about 15 years. I think it started in Boston, but has really spread throughout most major cities. There are two components to Housing First. The first is that instead of requiring someone to move through, go from homelessness to emergency housing to transitional to permanent housing, this is really, let's take someone off of the street and move them into Housing First. And the second component to Housing First is that housing is what counts. And then permanent supportive services are wrapped around the individual once they're in housing. Once you develop that relationship with someone, then you can work on the mental health issues, the substance abuse issues, the social skills, work, job readiness, those kinds of things once they're in housing.
And that is a huge thing, because if a person doesn't have the housing, if they're living on the street, it's so hard, even if they're not living on the street, if they don't have a permanent location, it's so hard for them to make that next step.
That is so true. Well, we found our first Housing First, our initial Housing First effort was a de-encampment partnership with the city. We moved 100 people into housing, chronically homeless individuals into housing, 3 years ago. The Housing Authority leased 100 apartments from landlords, 13 different property owners, and we had the lease initially in our name because landlords were a little reluctant to serve and to house, to rent to these individuals. 3 years later, 80% of those units are now in the tenant's name, and the tenant is paying rent directly. And we've had great successes. People have gone back to school. They've reunited with their family. They've gotten jobs. It is just tremendously successful when you look at what is happening within the lives of these individuals.
Is that sort of what led to the idea of then building permanent residence. If you were able to do that and rent out different places and you have that kind of success, because 84% is a very good success rate. And once you start that, was that, and I know it's something that the housing authority has been looking at that, but did it make you feel like, okay, we are on the right track? We see that if we can put people in housing and then move from there, we can start having successes.
Well, we've been wanting to do the physical units, the permanent housing, right from the beginning as well, but it takes time to assemble the financing. What we know is that on a financial basis, the net present value of investment in a physical unit is much less over 30 years than rental assistance for someone. And so we see this as financially the right answer for our community and for taxpayers, to be quite honest. But it takes time to build something. So we want to have a combination of rental assistance and housing people through rental assistance with private landlords, as well as us providing housing. And once we have a housing development, we actually can bring services to a larger number of people once it's a little bit centralized. And so there are multiple models that we're trying to implement, but it's all around housing first. Primarily.
And you looked, and when you talk about multiple models, now just yesterday you opened one of your largest projects with, I think, 60?
70.
70 units. Mm-hmm. Now you did open a smaller housing
right.
Facility, but for people with who had special needs.
Well, so this is our third Renaissance development. We call them Renaissance at. So Renaissance at Trinity is 20 units for chronically homeless, 15 individuals with severe mental illness. Renaissance at Altamonte opened up earlier this month, and that is all 30 units are set aside for chronically homeless as well as with severe mental illness. Renaissance at Santa Clara, which I think of really as our most important and most visible development, is 70 units, of which 25 are set aside for people with severe mental illness. What we found at Renaissance at Trinity, which has been open for a little over a year, we have had some successes and some failures. We actually have had two residents who died once they moved in, which sounds sad, but at the same time, this means that they died with dignity.
They didn't die on the street.
They did not, which is really important, I think, for many people in this community is to provide dignity to people. We have had a couple of people that unfortunately didn't meet the requirements of their lease, and we had to terminate their lease, which if you're in a homeless development and you lose your lease, you're probably going back out on the street, which is really hard for us to do. But we know it's the right thing. We have to do what is right for the property. But we've had other individuals who have gone back to work, who've connected with their families, who have gone through alcohol and substance abuse counseling, and who've received their degrees at Fresno City. Some are now working on their degrees at Fresno State. We've just had great successes with our Housing First.
How have the other agencies responded to this? Because really, that's how this whole thing works. Many of the people who are on the street are on the street for a reason, whether it be economics or some other situation. So they are going to need assistance. How are the other agencies coming forward to help provide that?
So our primary partnership with our Renaissance developments is with Fresno County and the Department of Behavioral Health. At Santa Clara, we're really expanding our partnership with other service providers. And we have so many people coming to the table, starting with Poverello House. But we have Fresno State and some of their students working on their master's in social work coming and working with us. But it's also nonprofits who provide substance abuse or alcohol counseling or housekeeping. We have a nonprofit that works with our residents on housekeeping issues. The partnership, the Housing Authority can't do it alone. We have to do it in partnership. And we're really excited. We have a partnership with the EOC to do housing where we provide housing, they provide services to transitional aged youth, TAY, population. And we have a partnership with WestCare to work with families. And so we see that this is really what we need to do is to grow the number of people who are really who are working with this population, with the homeless population and the many subgroups within it. There are 30 nonprofits in this community. They're part of the continuum of care that provide about 1,800 housing units. And so it really is about partnering with them, growing the number of units that we have, and addressing those 5,000 homeless individuals that we have.
Because when you take a look at Fresno County, as you mentioned, we have a number of agencies who do serve different population groups, whether or not it's low income, whether it's not people who are mentally ill. And so it would only seem to make sense for everybody to kind of come together. If you already have the services, find a way to kind of bring them together to do this instead of everybody being off on their doing right. their individual thing.
Well, I think that the 30 nonprofits and there's some others like Clinica Sierra Vista that provides health care to the homeless. I mean, we have great conversations about how we can work together. But there are some people who work with the homeless, the police department, the sheriff's department, the hospitals, and they are organizing themselves and coming up with some great solutions. So what we need to do is connect what we're doing within the nonprofit world with these very large public institutions, and then to bring in the private sector. The Fresno Business Council is really interested in helping us end this epidemic of homelessness. And I see a new collaborative environment where we are coming together, sharing our resources, asking the question, are we doing this right? And if we're not, how can we do it better?
How can we do it right?
Right. And I think that that is happening.
Now, the Santa Clara Project, it is at this point, and I know there were some people who were concerned about that, it is next to in the same area as a homeless encampment that the city's been having a very difficult time as far as getting those people into to look at an alternative situation. What do you do in a situation like that? Because you have – you do have a group of people who for them they've made this decision to live on the street, even though you're trying to provide the services and the housing for them. How do you yeah. How do you reconcile that?
Well, we did not place Renaissance at Santa Clara without a lot of thought. We thought hard about it, is what I'm trying to say. We had a lot of conversations with the continuum of care members. I'll be quite honest, the Mental Health Board, Fresno County Mental Health Board, which is volunteers who are looking at the issue of mental health within Fresno County, were not happy with the location of this development next to Pavrello. And to tell you the truth, we know that we have tough a tough road down, in front of us to make sure that the residents who we house don't go right back out their front doors into this life and into this world that we're trying to get them out of, whether it's with alcohol or other attractive nuisances. I don't know the right way of saying it, these harmful things that are right out their doorstep. But we really wanted to put this housing in at ground zero with Pavrello there. 45 of the 69 residents that have leases lived on the street around Ventura, around Pavrello. So we're moving people who lived on the street right there into our housing.
Wow.
So we feel like we're making an impact on that population, on the people who live there.
And if they stay there long enough and access start really accessing the services, then I'm sure you're thinking about that's how you can start changing, because they will start changing, because that's what has to be done.
They
have to take a look. Maybe they'll look out the window and say, you know, that's not the life I want.
Right. Well, and I do believe that people who are on the street do not want to be on the street. And I've read comments to the opening of our development yesterday where people are saying, well, people want to live on the street. That's their choice. And I don't believe that that's the case. When I talk to individuals and hear their stories, sometimes – look, one thing that makes us as Americans is that we're really proud of ourselves, right? And so when you say to someone, you live on the street, well, their initial reaction is going to be, yeah, I live on the street. I'm tough. I can do this. But when you really talk to them, you realize that they're scared. 3 a.m., they don't know what's outside their tent. And they want the same stability that the rest of us
want. It's just knowing where to start. Well, I would think with many of them.
It is.
And taking that first step is hard, especially if you've been on the street for a long time.
Right. And sure, they've built up, you know, they've built up their friendships. They built up their safety network.
That's
with
their
people.
Family.
It is their family. So we need to help them with a new framework, a new structure, so that they can realize that some of the choices that they were making were not the right choices. And the successes we've had and the success that Housing First has had throughout the country shows that people will start making better choices when given the opportunity.
When you talk about the success of Housing First throughout the country, because like you said, it's not a new concept. Did you all look at some of the other models before really pushing forward with it here? And what is it that you saw and some of the places that maybe you researched that you wanted to bring back some of what they were doing here and really felt that that was the approach that Fresno really needed to take to start working toward a solution for this problem?
Well, so back in December of 2007, the Fresno City and Fresno County came together and started writing a 10-year plan. There was a 10-year plan to end homelessness that really came out of the nonprofit world, but the city and county wanted to broaden that to incorporate more public partners and to really bring the private sector to the table. And during that process, there was a lot of investigation into Housing First. At the same time, we were exploring, as a housing authority, we were exploring Housing First. And so we went down to L.A., looked at some of the developments there, San Francisco. We went to Seattle and visited a number of developments in Seattle. We got to know what was working, some things that we should think about. We talked with other housing authorities in Salt Lake City, Santa Barbara, where they were taking the lead in developing Housing First projects. And so we did a lot of research. And yet, at the same time, to be quite honest, this is a pretty big leap of faith. You know, it's like we've built something. And to tell you the truth, the building of it, while it's been really hard, is the easy part. Now we've got to maintain the asset, make sure that the community sees that this is a strong addition to the community and that they like to see more. But we've also got to provide the services. We got to make sure that we can help the individuals who come into the housing. So our hard work is really in front of us, not behind us.
Okay. How do you feel about that? When you talk about the hard work being in front of you, I mean, you've mentioned that, and it really is getting, isn't it part of it, getting the community to just become vested in this whole idea? And that I'm sure there's almost everybody who's come across or who've seen the homeless encampments downtown. And is it part of the community saying, you know what, we can do better than that? We can be better than that.
Right. I think we have to. So I got to tell you, every morning I feel like I should just pull the covers back over my head. I mean, I feel like we've created this great momentum. And yet at the same time, the responsibility is pretty daunting. And we have great staff at the Housing Authority. We have great partnerships with people at Fresno City and Fresno County. We're ready for this challenge. But to say that we are not scared or not nervous would be a lie. You know, we go in this with our eyes wide open, knowing that there's a lot of work in front of us. And to tell you the truth, you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, if we've got 5,000 homeless individuals on the street right now, and I think that about 2/3 are unsheltered and 1/3 are sheltered, meaning that they might be in emergency housing, but they're still technically homeless. That we've got a lot of work in front of us. And that means we've got to prove to the community, to the taxpayers, that they want to do more of these. And so they need to see that we're having a great impact on people's lives, that people are being accountable and responsible for themselves, that the asset is being well maintained. So we're not going to do the next renaissance in the same area around Poverello. I like to see it in another part of Fresno or in Fresno County somewhere. Because to tell you the truth, who we're serving are people who were born and raised here in Fresno from all parts of Fresno. And I mean Fresno County, not just Fresno City. So we need housing options throughout the county so people can integrate back into their lives that they came from, back into the communities that they came from.
Do you expect that to be a difficult sale for some communities?
Yes.
There are people who really didn't like the idea of it going up across the street from an encampment. But as you stated, you know, you're close to the Poverello House and Rescue Mission, a place where there are services as well. So there was a method to what you're trying to accomplish. But then when you say, okay, we need to spread out, you know, it's just like anything else that comes along. People are like, you know, I like this concept, but, you know, I don't necessarily want it in my backyard. But you will let – but when you think about it, I mean, we can all drive down the street in every single one of our neighborhoods and you're going to see somebody out on the street, mm-hmm. you know.
We did in partnership with DBH, we did 6 units of housing for families that had a child with mental illness, which is a large population within our community. And I'm not going to name the community. It's a city outside of Fresno. City. It's in the county. At the city council meetings, we heard from a lot of community members who said, we don't want that housing in our community. Well, these were children who were already from that neighborhood, and really that family just needed some housing assistance so that then they could provide stability so their child could become healthy or healthier. And so we know that we have to, again, it's about proving what we're doing to help educate and to advocate for the families we serve, to show that they are part of the community and that this is actually beneficial to everyone to have quality housing for both individuals or families who need it. So.
But you're also holding the tenants accountable as well.
We are. So Housing First, and this isn't necessarily the family with the child with mental illness.
Right. But that's a whole different situation.
So when we take someone off of the streets, someone who's chronically homeless, we do not require sobriety. We do not require that they stop using illegal substances. When they sign a lease, they can't use those things out on the doorstep, kind of thing. But we know that they're going to be doing some things within their units that may not sit well with us as a community. But our goal through Housing First is to make that relationship and then to help people start making the changes within their lives. And I think that makes people nervous. I think that in Fresno County, which I think is a wonderful community, but we definitely believe in individual responsibility. And so sometimes, many times I hear people who don't appreciate the approach we're bringing, but we know the success that it has. And so we'll keep doing it and we'll keep, you know, hopefully educating people that we can take someone directly off the street who has issues and that they can turn their lives around.
But then too, it's also, what is the alternative? You know, you do have people who, as you say, this is a community for people. It is all about personal responsibility. But there are times that individuals do need some help.
Yeah. So, I mean, the alternative is that they're going to be out on the street. What happens then? We did a study. We know that it costs about $30,000 a year to keep someone on the street, because we have repeated police and fire response to emergencies. We have people going to the hospital, to the emergency room when they are ill. Usually they go way too late in their illness so they get some treatment. Then they go back out on the street. They don't really recover. They go back into the hospital. So we know that just—
It is costing the city. I think one of the things all you have to look at is the situation that the city went through a few years ago with being sued by a group of homeless people mm-hmm. who had their belongings moved and stored it was alleged improperly. And so the city had to pay out for that. When you think about how much the city had to pay out for that and may continue to have to pay out for those sorts of things, that money could be spent.
Right. Well, right. So the issue is, how do you take – and this is why it's so exciting to have the sheriff and the police department, so Chief Dyer and Sheriff Mims and the hospitals coming to the table, is that they do have large expenditures that if we can figure out how to house people, that they will see a drop in those expenditures. What does that mean? It really means that taxpayers will see fewer costs. And if we can really figure out how we can show that housing then reduces these other expenses, I think that just on a financial basis, we'll say this is the right thing to be doing. And I just cannot leave the issue, the moral issue. We cannot have people dying on the street. That's the other alternative. And that's just one that I think we as a society shouldn't accept.
And we do have the situation when you talk about cost, again, having people become ill or dying and they end up in county emergency rooms that, excuse me, we all have to pay for anyway. We have situations now, even when it gets cold, the city has to open up shelters for people who are on the street because they have no place else to go. And you're right when you talk about being just humane. If temperatures are below freezing, you're not going to leave people out on the street.
And I think we also do it when it gets too hot on the streets here, too. So
right.
In the summertime.
So that part is a cost.
Right.
So when it comes to moving forward, you've opened Santa Clara. You have another project that you'd like to move forward with as well?
Well, right now, so the Housing Authority's got a pretty comprehensive approach. We house 140 homeless veterans through a partnership with the VA. We house 160 homeless families and individuals in partnership with four different nonprofits. As I said, we have this new partnership with the WestCare and EOC. We housed almost 900 individuals through a partnership with the city in Fresno County called Homeless Prevention and Rapid Rehousing. So what we're going to do is we're really going to take a little bit of not a breather, maybe a moment of reflection. And we want to get together again with Fresno City, Fresno County, elected officials, business leaders, the faith-based community, the service partners, and really ask, what is the next step? Do we do another Renaissance deal? Or is there another answer that we need to be doing at this time and building on our successes?
How does the mayor's First Step Home program work into what you're trying to do?
It's fantastic. So the Housing Authority has been the primary recipient of the funds raised by the Fresno First Steps Home. And we have done two different efforts with those dollars. One of them, as we built Santa Clara, we knew that there were individuals on the streets nearby, the Renaissance at Santa Clara, that need to be housed. And so with Fresno First Steps Home dollars and funds from the Housing Authority, we're able to house some individuals and provide them services. Individuals who may not have qualified to live in our development for different reasons, but we are able to get them into other housing. So I think Fresno First Steps Home has raised about $800,000. I think the mayor's goal is $1 million a year for the next few years. We are at the table with her talking about the great successes. I think there needs to be other recipients besides the Housing Authority so we can really address homelessness. But Fresno First Steps Home is a great program. Everyone should give to that program.
It's very simple. What does she say, a dollar? Everybody gives a dollar?
A dollar a month and we'll do okay, exactly.
But one of the other things, too, when you talk about what we're facing here with the homeless situation, going through and trying to research more on this topic and taking a look at what other communities are doing to work toward a solution, because that's what you're trying to do, work toward a solution. It's not solve the crisis, but try to work toward a solution. And one of the things I came across was the fact that someone had mentioned, if you think of it this way, and they had pulled together a group of people, and it was the fact that if you take a look at the people who are on the street as that's someone's mother, that's someone's brother, that's someone's sister, that's someone's father. And those people, at some point, there is a family out there somewhere. And if you can put a face on the homeless in that respect, then perhaps you get people taking a look at it in a different way. And that these people, they do belong to somebody.
They do. They are our brothers and sisters, our parents, our children. I totally agree with you. These are our Fresnans who have really fallen on very tough, hard times. And so, but for the grace of God, is not one
especially
of us,
especially in this particular, in this economic climate that we've been through for the last 2 to 3 years. It's placed a lot of people in a very precarious kind of situation.
Right.
And if they weren't homeless, I'm sure there are a number of people going through this whole economic crisis that probably came very close to it and were probably wondering what they would do next.
Right. Well, so and you're so right that there are a number of people who have just have some kind of situation, an incident that needs to be addressed, a medical issue, they lost their job. And so that's what homeless prevention and rapid rehousing is about, is to step into those situations so that someone doesn't end up on the street for a long period of time, but we can get them back into housing. Typically it's less than 6 months that they're able to get stabilized and stop receiving any kind of assistance. So we have that group of people. The chronically homeless is the one that we're really focusing on at the Housing Authority because of the extreme cost that it has on our community, the fragile nature that they have, the vulnerability that they have. We're working really hard to do what we call a vulnerability index. So we're looking at people's health and really understanding their condition so that we can then rank them as who needs housing first and who should we house first, and the most vulnerable is at the top of that list. That's how we got 45 people to move into who will be moving into a Renaissance at Santa Clara. They came from our vulnerability index right from the area around the property.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Preston, for coming in, and just good luck with what you're trying to do.
Thanks.
Preston Prince, director of the Fresno Housing Authority, here to speak about how you're moving forward in an effort to find a solution to homelessness here in Fresno and Fresno County.
And it's not just the Housing Authority, it's the community. Anyone who'd like a tour or want to give ideas, they can always give me a call.
Okay, you heard that. Thanks a lot. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. This week, the nation pauses both to give thanks and to give back to those in need. Earlier this year, one Fresno couple had an idea to do just that, with the goal of changing hundreds of young lives in Fresno. The two established a program for students at Fresno Unified's Tehipity Middle School, which will award a college scholarship to all students who complete high school, earn a 3.0 grade point average, and perform community service. The Farbers established a program with a $1 million gift in honor of their late son, Steve. Earlier this year, we had a chance to talk with the Farbers and Tehipity Middle School principal, Yvonne Zeisling. Mr. Farber, what went into your decision to choose Tehipity Middle School as the school for your endowment?
The kids at Tehipity did impress us when we met them. We know it's an impoverished neighborhood, and we want to give them a fair chance at life. And when we met the parents and children, we were quite impressed. The parents were very thankful. They blessed us. And also we were impressed by the principal and the teachers. A couple of the teachers told us they actually cried when they heard about what happened. And I personally have been very impressed by the principal, Yvonne Zeisling. I was impressed by what she's done at the school. And so we're hopeful that we can do something to help these children.
Francine?
Also, Tehipity is in the Lowell-Jefferson area, which is the focus of a lot of improvement efforts throughout the city. For example, the mayor has hoped to revitalize that particular area, which is in disrepair, really. And also, the organization Reading and Beyond, of which I happen to be a board member, has a grant to focus on that particular area also. And so we thought, well, we should really pile it all on and see if together we can all make a real difference in the lives of these students.
And Mr. Farber, some of the things that you mentioned, I think, would be very important if you look at the success of students and children. They've got to have, they've got to be at a school with the right principal. They have to have the right attitude, and the parents must be involved to kind of make this all happen.
These are children who have wonderful ambitions, and meeting with them, the children talked about wanting to be a veterinarian, a police officer, a marine, a nurse.
An artist.
These kids deserve a break, too, and this is what we're hoping to do. But I think one of the big things we want to do, in addition to helping the individual children at Tehipity, is hope this serves as a model for others in Fresno to think about corporations or individuals who could do something. This could be a model that could be picked up and helping children at other schools.
And we've all witnessed what's happened to education in this state. And so what you're saying, there is a way for the community, the public corporations, to kind of come in and help balance this out.
There are organizations that can jump in and help in different ways. When we were at Tehipity, we met members of Rotary who were helping the arts, buying instruments for children. For those who can't give big time, hey, there are other things you can do. The schools need help, yeah. And there's room for lots of individuals to help in various ways, big or small.
You know, Juanita, there are four criteria.
Oh, I was going to say students have to earn this, right?
It's not a free ride at all. First of all, they have to have 95% attendance, and we want to hold them to that because if you're not in school, you really can't learn. Secondly, the coursework that they take has to meet the California A through G requirements, which are kind of mysterious to some people, but really they're 13 different courses that you have to take in order in social studies, science and math and so forth, in order to meet the requirements for a UC school. So we want these children to be college ready. Thirdly, they have to maintain a B average, a 3.0 average. And fourthly, annually, they have to do community service. So I see that as an opportunity for the community to jump in. For example, the grounds are really well taken care of there, but they don't have any flowering shrubs or flowers, as a matter of fact.
That's a great community project.
So if some of the local nurseries want to contribute to that, that would be great. The kids could do the planting and taking care of all of that. So that would be a nice thing to do.
Now let's bring in the principal, Yvonne Zeisling. What do you think? How can this impact the students at Tehipity, you think?
Well, this incredible gift is just giving so much hope to our Tehipity students and our families and our communities. Suddenly, grades and grade point average and good attendance has a tangible purpose that our students can really grasp. It's something that they can hold on to. And again, it's a scholarship opportunity that's within their reach, and it's doable. It's given our students and our teachers hope, purpose, direction, and our parents have embraced the opportunity with open arms.
And, you know, when you take a look at each of the criteria, you look at ways that it could so benefit not just the students, but the school and the community, because you're talking about, first of all, these students have to have good attendance. So hopefully your attendance rate goes up, mm-hmm. as well as the graduation rates.
Yes.
Can I say
that? Yes, that's certainly an impact, an immediate impact. And again, I echo what Francine said. The students have to be in their seats to learn. And in order to meet the rest of the criteria. So just having the students there is a huge positive. And the community service aspect is huge. We have some events ongoing throughout the school year, but there's certainly many more opportunities, and we look forward to partnering with the Cultural Arts Rotary Club in some of those community service activities.
Francine?
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify something. After our son Steve passed away, just 11 years ago next week, actually, his wife very wisely kind of took a chunk of the estate and put it aside for something special. And she's been asking us to come up with a project that we thought we would like that would be beneficial for the community and also something that Steve would like very much. So it's really through her generosity that this endowment has been made. It's funds from our son's estate that have flowed to Fresno, even though they never lived in Fresno, and she doesn't even live in California.
And
so she's been very generous.
This endowment was named and made in the honor of your son.
Right. It's called Steve's Scholars.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Since we moved to Fresno, we found a lot that we like about Fresno, even though Fresnans seem to put themselves down.
I find that a lot from people who move here. They have a whole different take on Fresno.
We have found Fresno very welcoming, at the same time that there certainly is some big houses here, there's this impoverished area, and that's the part that attracted us, that feeling that there's a need to help there.
And I just kind of want to go back to how this whole thing started. How did your son kind of inspire you to do this?
Well, he was a very generous person, as well as a fun-loving person. And he liked to do big things, and he loved to read. That was very important to him. And as he was able to, he began to give money to some educational purposes. He had a friend who was in charge of a special school in New York City. And when he heard it was a school specifically for immigrants and other people who had not had the opportunity to go to a regular high school, and he heard of some needs there, and he took care of them. He went to his old high school in Connecticut for a visit and found that one of the teachers needed a new computer, and he bought a whole system for her. So, I mean, he did like to do things related to education, so this seemed like a good thing to do.
And I know that both of you are strong supporters of Fresno schools.
Yes.
And what do you think now about the direction of the district, and how do you think what you're doing and other community involvements could really do to help? Because when you take a look at Fresno Unified, you have to look at the district as a whole, and that it's so huge, and the diversity and all the different challenges.
We're really very happy with this direction that Superintendent Hansen and the board are taking the school district. They were all wonderfully cooperative in helping us design all the details of this project, which took a lot of their time. But we also think that with the graduation task force and their recommendations and other things that have been accomplished, certainly the fiscal solidarity that the superintendent has brought to the district, we think these are very, very important things, and we're pleased. We know there's a long way to go. There's a lot to do, and the superintendent knows that as well, and he's running as fast as he can.
We like the fact that we've seen graduation rates increase, and there's still a way to go, and we hope we can help through our gift.
And I think also when you look at what you two are trying to do, it's a great example. Because we can all sit back and criticize, or we can all kind of step up and say, I want to be a part of this. I want to try to change things. I want to try to make things better. And that's where the community can become involved, and also working and supporting the improvements in the schools. And when you take a look at what's happening in the Lowell community, you're saying, okay, we have this one area that we're going to pour a lot of resources in, but there are so many other communities that really need the same thing.
Right, and there's no point in being negative. You know, I think if you take a positive outlook and feel that something you do can indeed make a difference, then, you know, it probably will. But this is a very long-term project, and we hope to have benchmarks along the way. Every year, the school people are going to let us know how things are going, and we're going to also do some special activities with the kids. So it's not just in 2018 that they're going to get the money. They're going to get other things along the way that we hope to institute, like trips to colleges, mentors coming in, special community activities like taking care of the grounds of the school and so forth. So
when we were at the school the other night, there are parents who came with their seventh graders and younger children, and we try to get across to them, this is not a one-time thing. This is an endowed gift, so that there'll be money each year. And as we looked at some of the smaller children, we got across to their parents, when these children grow up and become seventh graders, they'll be part of the program too. They'll be Steve's scholars. It doesn't end with a one-shot. This is an ongoing thing.
And so this really starts for, it starts earlier because it can encourage students starting at a very early age to focus mm-hmm. on their education. Mm-hmm. But Steve Scholars is for the seventh graders at Tehipity, starting right there.
Starting there, but they have to stay in, follow the requirements, and graduate from a Fresno high school. And then they'll get the scholarship at the end of the rainbow.
And it's a two-year deal. They do well their first year. They get the money for a second year.
Right. So there is a lot of incentive there. And not only that, I think what is really good about this, too, is you look at where you started. You started in seventh grade realizing that if they don't get what they need before they get to high school, it's going to be difficult.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes kids of that age only think of the immediate, you know, and 12th grade may seem a million years away. But I think this makes it a little more realistic for them. They know there's a certain finite time in which they really have to work hard. And these kids are used to working hard for everything they get.
And sorry about that. Principal Seisling, I'd like to ask you this again. We almost totally forgot about you because we're enjoying this conversation. But how have your kids responded to this? And when does this start with them?
Well, this started immediately. We had an assembly. They were able to meet the Farbers and have the criteria outlined to them, and it's game on. We have started. Progress reports have come out for the first 4 weeks of work, and there's a huge focus on grade point average, attendance.
It started with this year's seventh graders.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. And they know that this is a program that's going to follow them and support them grade 7 through 12. And we've established a nice working relationship with Roosevelt High School and their principal. And those counselors are aware of Steve Scholars program and the cohort of students that will be progressing through Tehipity and then on to Roosevelt. And I might say that in my conversation and collaboration with the elementary schools that send their sixth graders to Tehipity, there's already enthusiasm brewing at their level because those students coming in next year will be a part of the Steve Scholars opportunity. So our students, the effect I'm seeing already on our campus is that students are more positive and they believe in this opportunity. They've met the Farbers. They really don't want to let the Farbers down. This has become very tangible to them, and the Farbers don't know this yet. I'm happy to share this, but we've already seen increased parent involvement in the parent education programs that we offer twice a week. Parents are coming with their questions and want to know how they can be involved. They want to know more about the A through G requirements and what it's going to take for their student to get into college and earn this scholarship.
And I think what you see here, too, is when you talk about this incentives, and it's not just an incentive. I think also what you're doing is telling these kids, you have somebody else who cares about you and kind of cares about your future. And, you know, that's a huge motivator for students.
I must add something. I truly, deeply appreciate Principal Yvonne's enthusiasm. In visiting the campus more than once to see her talking to the children and the fact that she knows so many of the first names. And so I think she's really responsible, helpful, deserves a lot of credit for building the enthusiasm.
You know, each of the seventh graders was given a T-shirt that we designed, and on the front it says Steve Scholars, and on the back it has the four requirements that they have to meet. So when they're walking behind somebody, they're going to read it every day.
They see it every day. Well, this is an absolutely wonderful program coming from two wonderful people who are putting, you know, what they say and what they believe to work. So Murray and Francine Farber, thank you so much. Thank you for the endowment, and thank you for being here this morning for the discussion, as well as Principal Zeisling. And that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.